Today in Studio 360, Charlie Wilson was born ready for the spotlight.
Because I got the heart of a giant, a king, and a lion. Trust me, man. I said, just give me the microphone and I'll prove to you what I'm talking about.
I'll talk with Wilson about the days he spent as a new R&B superstar in the 70s and 80s and the nights he spent sleeping in the bushes. Plus, the great American poet Mary Jo Bang got a very late start, and she plans to use what time she's got left wisely.
Once you get into your 60s, you know that you have X amount of time, and X, we can't solve for X, but it's X now.
Mary Jo Bang will subtract a little bit from X and spend it here with us. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, even if you don't know Charlie Wilson's name, you know his voice.
Gee, I feel so lucky now to have you all alone, girl.
As the lead singer of the Gap Band, Wilson defined the sound of R&B and funk in the 1980s with hits like You Dropped a Bomb on Me, Burn Rubber on Me, and Outstanding.
You blow my mind, baby. I'm so alive.
That sound went on to influence another couple generations of singers who've led R&B back into the pop mainstream, R. Kelly and Justin Timberlake and D'Angelo. But back when the Gap Band's music was going great, Wilson's life went awry. He got addicted to cocaine and booze and ended up living on the streets in Los Angeles. He's got a new memoir called I Am Charlie Wilson, in which he tells his whole story, including the so far very happy ending, back to making big hits in his 50s and now early 60s. Charlie Wilson, it's a pleasure to have you on Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
And you are just off a 46-city arena tour.
Yes.
You told me. Why aren't you sleeping?
No, I wish I could. That's a good one.
So you grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a Pentecostal preacher father and a mom who was a music teacher and very religious. You got your start singing as a little tiny kid in church, yeah?
Yeah, about 3 years old.
Yeah? Do you remember the first time you got up to do that?
Mm-hmm. I had my father, I was like the warm-up act, I guess.
Yeah.
My father used to, he was very energetic in the pulpit, and he was...
That's Pentecostalism.
All over the place. Yeah. He was up and down the aisles and everything, so he used to really jump like 2 or 3 feet up off the ground all the time. So I was just watching him. So the first time I sang, I was a little nervous, and my mom was playing, "That's okay, baby, sing," you know.
Yeah, kind of yeah. That.
The second time I sang the solo, I had the microphone, and I just headed down the aisle. It was Mark and my father.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
At three, you were playing the audience.
3 or 4 years old, yeah, I started playing.
Your mother was very devout, remained very devout, it sounds like. She called all modern music the blues, according to your book. How did you and your brothers convince her that you should play this satanic music?
I mean, even as a kid, I mean, we had to go next door to listen to any secular music.
And there's a great scene of you doing just that and hearing the man who was then called Little Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, I heard that, and I was like, wow. I said, well, who is that? They said, his name is Stevie Wonder. They called him Little Stevie Wonder. I was like, oh, let me do it. I want to be able to do that. And the mom said, you're not singing no blues, baby. I was like, no, but I can get him. Let me do it. She's like, no, you're not going to do that. But, you know, of course, you know, a couple of years later, you know, my dad, he was like, because his nephew was Lord Fulson, the blues singer. So, you know, but he would come and go a lot, and we'd see him in those big shiny Cadillacs and his hair slicked back. And I was like, wow, one day I'm going to look like that. And so, I mean, he was like, oh, let the boys go on and play something that, you know, it ain't going to hurt them.
So you and your brothers eventually formed a band called the Gap Band, which is an acronym for the main streets in a black neighborhood in Tulsa, right?
Greenwood Arch and Pine Street.
Yeah, band. Which I only just learned. I had Leon Russell on the show a few weeks ago, and I understand that you got your big break through him, right? Your fellow Oklahoman?
Yeah. We ended up being his band, and I was a little bit too energetic for him, I think. I was jumping off on his piano, jumping off, and, you know. I remember when we was his band. I mean, first time we became his band, first he came into a club to see us, I think they were beer drunk or something. I don't know if he remembered the story, but he was kind of beer drunk.
I can imagine that.
He was beer drunk, and then he came back I think the next weekend. But I said, well, what was these white boys with the with nice, you know, just clean cut. And there was the same guys, all of him and his friends, but they weren't drunk this time. So we took a break. And when I met him, he says, Leon Russell. I was like, wow. He, I said, well, you, weren't you here last week? He said, yeah, but I was beer drunk. I was drunk. I said, so he says, I just wanted to make sure I heard what I heard last week. I said, did you hear it? Yeah, I heard exactly what I heard. You guys are good. And I remember we went on the road. We used to open, and the Gap Band would have three songs. And, man, I was cutting up. Then it would be down to two songs. And then it was down to one song. Then it was down to no songs. All of a sudden, we turn around. He walking out. I was like, oh, he done took all the songs from me. Because I was cutting up. I was humping speakers and doing everything. I mean, he was like, no, you ain't doing that.
You were too much of a rock star?
Well, at that time, I didn't know. I was. But, I mean, I remember all of the write-ups, all of the bottom parts were torn off. He had tore off all the write-ups because I was stealing the show. And he said that was it. And I was like, wow, this is it? Oh, man, the career's over already.
And it clearly wasn't. And
no.
One thing you write about that was interesting to me is you improvise on stage, as you say, cutting up in various ways.
Yeah.
And you record the performances, and then you go back and say, oh, I'm going to use that. Or I made up this song on the spot. Like, what's an example of doing that?
Well, like Drop the Bomb. We would get into a groove and we would catch that groove and stay in it for a minute, and then the whole show and when we get off the stage, we go to the bus and we put the tape in, listen to the show back, and we would listen to the parts that was grooving, and some of those parts had those same elements that's on the record. We would just take that and say, oh wow, that's a song right there, and we would throw it in the box for recording next when we get home.
And for somebody who, as you write, was partying pretty hard and drinking and using drugs and everything, that sounds so sort of systematic that you were still like keeping it together on a certain level.
Well, I mean, you know, we weren't like we would, you know, you just nipping and nipping and nipping, and you can keep nipping and nipping until you nip out. But those were the early stages of nipping and trying things.
Yeah.
And nobody would know we had too much to drink or too much drugs. Nobody would ever know that. You know?
No, and you did, as you say, nip out eventually.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, people, musicians becoming addicted and all that is almost too common of a story to talk about, but you went further down than one usually hears about.
Yeah.
You ended up living on the street. Did people ever, I mean, you were well known. Did people ever recognize you and say, hey, is that Charlie Wilson?
Oh, yeah. Everybody in the that particular neighborhood recognized me. And knew,
in Los Angeles.
But they didn't know. I was in Hollywood. The studios were in Hollywood. So my storyline to them was that I've been in the studio all night. So they all believed that all the time.
Really?
I just used that all the time. And so I would hide out in certain places, and would be just hiding in bushes and sleeping in different places. It was weird.
So in your early 40s, your cousin, with whom you'd been getting high for years, suddenly says, Charlie, this has got to stop. Talk about how that happened.
Well, she just ran into me one day, and I was, it was toward the evening, I think. And I looked at her, and she said, I said, cuz, that you? She was like, oh, and she just started crying off right off the bat. And I noticed that her face was really, really high yellow and really nice. She didn't look like a junkie anymore. And she said, I've been clean for 3 years. I said, 3 years? It's been that long since I've seen you? She's like, yeah. Where you been? You been here? I was like, I've been here. She's like, and she really started crying. And then she said, I was dying. You're dying. I think I weighed maybe 130, 129 pounds, maybe close to 120. She got me into this program. It was a 28-day program. And for 14 of the days, I was not acting like I was supposed to act. But I met this special person that was in there, and she was the doctor. And one day she asked me, what was I going to do when I got out? And I broke the cry, said, I don't have anywhere to go. She said, I won't let your feet hit the ground. And she started doing some things for me. And then I, tried to hug on her. And finally, after about a month or so, I talked her into marrying me. But that was 20 years ago, and this year. And I never had another relapse. I never drank any alcohol, never did anything else.
And not only that, which would be a pretty happy ending by itself, and you fell in love with and married your doctor, but also the music world came back and said, Charlie Wilson, he was really good, right? And Snoop Dogg and Justin Timberlake and Kanye West and all these people suddenly wanted to work with you.
Well, you know, it was rough in the beginning. I remember meeting Snoop and Snoop Dogg, and he told me he had seen me on the street one day, and he said, the one evening, and he said he cried. He said, "Man, it hurt me so much to see you. I was at a gas station. I was like, wow."
Funny, of course, that Snoop Dogg, famous for being weed user of all time, is worried about your drug use.
Yeah, but he said he saw me, and he said that was not the best scene. He couldn't believe that I was looking like that.
Yeah.
So, and then he had heard that I got myself together. But anyway, I went, and we worked together for about 9 rec albums of his.
Yeah.
And I was on everything, and that was catapulted me to a lot of other hip hop artists from that point on.
Well, and of course, and now we're 30, 40 years past your old songs, and 25, 35 years into hip hop, we see that what you did, you know, worked its way into that.
Yeah.
I want to play one of your hits from 36 years ago. This is Oops Upside Your Head. Which still sounds very contemporary. And then, of course, last fall, Bruno Mars and Mark Ronson released this song, which was called Uptown Funk. Which became this gigantic hit, the biggest single I read yesterday of the decade so far. A few months ago, those guys said, I guess we should call Charlie Wilson a co-writer and cut him in on the royalties. did that come easily, or did they just say, yeah, you busted us? We're
Hey man, I'm not finna go through all of that, but I tell you what, it was a.
You're laughing as I'm playing the music.
Well, I mean, hey, you know, it's like you take a little, you have to pay a little. You take a lot, you got to pay a lot. I mean, if you take a whole concept, then you got to pay a concept.
Yeah.
As simple as that. I mean, you know, I definitely love those guys, you know.
And you didn't have to sue him.
Well.
Threatened to sue him.
Well, see, you know what, Kurt? You trying to make me say something. See,
I'm just curious. I'm just curious.
Me, Mark Ronson, and Bruno Mars are real good. We're good together. We're good.
Really?
Me and Bruno, kind of tight. We good.
No hard feelings.
Hey, look. It was, you know, like you say, it was the biggest song of the decade. And nobody have any problems with the bank account is. Okay? Nobody's got a problem. They got enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Everybody's got enough.
I'm glad it all worked out for you.
Oh, sure. I'm happy too.
I could talk to you all afternoon. There are so few stories there are a lot of stories that have the rise and the fall, but the re-rise is almost unprecedented.
I mean, I am definitely blessed and honored, you know, and God, he truly has blessed me. And when I got up, when I got myself together, everybody in this business turned me down. Like 10 years, I looked for just somebody to sign me. But the woman that I married, she was saying, hey, listen, you just have to just keep going and don't worry about it. I said, but they told me I was too old when I approached them the first time. Now, mind you, 10 years later.
You're 50.
Yeah. they was like, is he serious about this?
Yeah.
It's like, man, you better not give me no microphone. The first time, whoever give it to me, I'm finna bust y'all up. You know, because I got the heart of a giant, a king, and a lion. Trust me, man. I said, just give me the microphone and I'll prove to you what I'm talking about.
Well, congratulations for that all working out.
Yeah.
Charlie Wilson, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Thank you, sir. Charlie Wilson's new memoir is called I Am Charlie Wilson. That was great.
We gonna go and bust you up? That's how we gonna end it? Charlie, you's a beast. How you gonna say you gonna bust somebody up? You should have been saying, I'm gonna be confident or something. Don't bust nobody up. That was a good one. I'll bust you up.
I was rolling in my car when I pulled up at the mall. Couldn't find a place to park. Threw my keys to the valet.
Hand it for me.
I was only there to hang, wasn't looking for a thing. I was just about to bounce. And then I saw Miss Lady. Then I said to myself,
to me, there are few greater pleasures than a good laugh. And with that in mind, we have extended a challenge to high school students to write or perform something funny. We've only got one rule. The first line of your entry has to be, "The sun rose and everything fell." And the last line must be, "Alex stared at the door handle and slowly turned the knob." Here is one of our entries from an 18-year-old listener named Christian.
The sun rose and everything fell. Everything. Every single damn thing on that shelf. I told Alex that the shelf he built wouldn't last a day, and look, 6 a.m. right on the dot. Alex never had good carpentry skills, so I should have expected.
You know how it ends, but you can read what comes in the middle and also check out lots of other entries and submit your own at studio360.org/funnyhaha. And hurry, all you humorous teenagers. The contest deadline is coming up quickly. It's August 3rd. Coming up, the budding neuroscientist Greg Dunn was preparing to start a career specializing in the cutting-edge field of epigenetics.
But to be honest, I was never really all that excited about it and was having a bit of a crisis.
How a little lost insect lifted him out of his crisis and totally changed his life. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. To tell you the truth, I am often underwhelmed by public art projects. Too many of them seem unoriginal or aesthetically meh or don't have much real public impact in the towns and cities where they're installed, which is why I am so excited by the public artwork in progress now unfolding in the little city of Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Each day for 26 straight weekdays, the front page of the local daily newspaper, the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise, is dominated by a giant custom-designed letter of the alphabet, supplied by 26 different designers from New England and seven countries around the world. And around that typographical centerpiece on the front page are stories connected to the letter. I think of it as kind of Sesame Street meets Our Town. The project has been masterminded by Anna Schulheit-Haber, a visual artist who is also a MacArthur genius and my friend, and she has pulled herself away from the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise printing presses to talk with me today about the project. Anna, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
So you came up with this brilliant idea. Oh, I can hijack the local newspaper for a month. But how did you convince the newspaper to go along with your insane scheme?
You know, use the word that I used in my head and it could never use in the beginning of the project because it was too scary for them. I never used the word hijack. So what I said was, I would like to be embedded with you. That's what I said. Uh-huh. And I said, would you like me to be your visiting artist? Because this is very special. The fact that this paper is still in operation in this small city. It's been in operation, amazingly, since 1838, which is
wow.
Older than the New York Times.
That's incredible.
Yeah, you are special in that you're everybody's newspaper. You flutter into someone's home. You are the news for half the day, and then you wane, and then you create the next news for the next day. It has that amazing 24-hour turnover. And I said, what if we connect the arts with your day-to-day rhythm? What if we use the actual front page to make art together, and the art would be visual as well as literal. It would be storytelling as well, and I would do this. But it can't be one day. It has to have a natural beginning, middle, and an end as a series. And they said, what are you thinking about? And I said, well, what if we used the letters of the alphabet, the most unemotional series that everyone can agree on? A five-year-old knows the alphabet and a 95-year-old knows it. And there were lots of meetings about this, and there were two or three crucial moments in the meetings when they offered me page three instead of page one, and I said I wouldn't do it at all.
Yeah.
The only risk we can take together that's worth mentioning is page one. It's the holy grail of the news.
Yep. And of course, people should realize that we're not talking about just a little letter in the corner of the front page. It's half the front page, sometimes more than half the front page. It really dominates the whole thing. And there are articles accompanying it. Like, for instance, I love the one you did for F about the guy who happened to be from Fitchburg who had essentially invented the pink plastic flamingo, starting with F, right?
Exactly, yes. We're trying to do local storytelling, but also just human interest stories that come submitted to us from the community, but also are generated by us as a team.
And are people responding? Are they collecting them? What's the mood of the people when they see that a crazy artist has taken over their newspaper for a month?
The responses have been wonderful so far. I've heard so many things, and they're all positive. And yes, there's collecting. People who missed certain letters are very much asking me and writing me how to find the letters that they don't have in their set. And that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted to create an urgency to really collect the paper.
Yeah. Well, I've been saying for years, as the digital age has thundered through, that print things, print books and magazines and newspapers would eventually become these precious artisanal objects. Is that what this project is about? Like a last hurrah for news and pictures on beautiful paper before that disappears?
You know, we're marking at the end of the era of print because there's a generation that's dying out that only reads the paper, mixing with a generation that reads the paper and our smartphones and tablets and computers, and then a generation coming in that is only digital. And we are marking that, but we're also marking the sheer beauty of something that is rare. There's a rarity to the paper version, which in the end lives a whole nother life than something that's on the web. That's what I'm excited about as an artist. I love the feeling of paper, the tactileness. I love the smell of the ink in the press room when I go there at midnight. It's wonderful. It's just an honor and a great joy to work with a newspaper.
Well, it is a quixotic quest you're on, and I'm glad you've done it. And I hope you get to Z without any major disasters.
Thank you, Kurt, so much. Thank you very much.
The Alphabet is taking over the front page of the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise every weekday through August 11th. And you can find out all the details at studio360.org.
Morning paper is on its way.
With paper and ink, you can do almost anything. Bring the news to thousands or millions of readers. Pass a note to your best friend in class or draw a picture of what's going on inside your head. Eric Malinsky, one of my colleagues here at Studio 360, met a scientist who became so enamored with what ink can do to paper that he ditched his medical research career to explore biology in a whole new way.
Neuroscience is a vast field. Here's how Greg Dunn describes it.
It's as if you're in New York. You know, there's like a little neighborhood for the electrophysiologists. There's a little neighborhood, you know, for the behaviorists and for the cellular specialists. It's quite a labyrinth.
When he was studying in grad school, Greg's neighborhood of neuroscience was epigenetics.
The basic premise behind epigenetics is it's really not anything more fancy than just learning. It's how your body learns.
For example, if a skinny person gains 100 pounds, will their future offspring be prone to obesity? Or if you experience a traumatic event, will your future offspring have anxious dispositions? It's an interesting cutting-edge field.
But to be honest, I was never really all that excited about it and was having a bit of a crisis. Because when I was in grad school, I don't feel like I was producing anything research-wise which others couldn't have produced. I was decent but not great.
He did have a knack for graphic design. He used to paint album covers to make extra money. And one night, he was dabbling with inks, and a bug landed on the piece of paper. He tried to blow it away.
And the jets of air that came out of my mouth blew the ink around in this just gorgeous pattern that's very, very reminiscent of the branching patterns of trees or neurons or a lightning bolt or something like this. It's a, it was just, you know, punching me in the face and screaming at me that this is such a logical connection between these two things.
I mean, this was not a scientific breakthrough, but for Greg, it was a personal breakthrough. He'd been feeling detached, and suddenly he felt awe towards the natural world.
In fact, the most dramatic example is when you look at orientations of galactic superclusters. You see these incredible threads of galaxies which are oriented amongst one another that look so similar to a neuron or a tree shape or something like this. It's really incredible. It's a shape which is fundamental to who we are and what our universe is made of.
So we started painting neurons in the style of Sumier artwork from East Asia. He showed me a couple of images of classical paintings from that era.
What you're looking at right here is a piece by Kano Sensetsu, who is a Japanese artist. This piece was produced around the 16th century. It's called The Old Plum. And what it depicts is a gnarled plum tree on a gold leaf background. And the branches of this plum tree are just taking all these crazy twists and turns. And so there are two images in this for me. There's the image of the tree and the rocks, which are really the principal part of the image. But then there's the image of the negative space, too.
His backgrounds are also just as interesting as the branches of neurons. But Greg's paintings are very high-tech. He etches neurons by hand onto large metal plates. And then he covers the surface with gold leaf to give it a reflective quality. The colors change depending on what angle you view the panels.
Depending upon the lighting, too, you can have them appear very bright or in silhouette as well. For example, if it's hanging next to a window and daylight's coming in, you won't see that blue background hardly at all. But you'll see all the satin-finished neurons very clearly. And then when you move the light around, as the light in the room changes, then different parts will start to come out, other parts will start to diminish. And for me, it's just adding visual interest into the piece.
He's been successful enough to become a full-time artist. But not everyone's a fan of his work.
I tend to be more on the photorealistic side of the spectrum. But even as far in that direction as I go apparently isn't enough for some neuroscientists who are such literalists that they'll pick it. Oh, no, the branching patterns. Clearly, you know, the internodal distance on a Purkinje neuron is, you know, 15 microns, not your 50 microns that you have here. You know, clearly you haven't done your research. And it's my opinion. It used to bother me. And at this point, my opinion on it is, you know, like it's art. Like, I'm doing this because I can bend the rules a little bit and I can caricature it how I see fit. And I really appreciate that kind of freedom. Because I'm not sure that it's really doing anybody any favors if you're just producing it exactly how it is and it doesn't capture your emotions.
He wants other artists to see the molecular world as an important subject, along the same lines as landscapes, nude models, or bowls of fruit.
Yeah, there's a constant source of inspiration there.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
You can see some of Greg Dunn's work at studio360.org. Still ahead, Mary Jo Bang's translation of Dante's Inferno is a little different from other versions you might have read. As far as we know, it is the only one to feature a character from South Park.
I thought, now who's the iconic figure of our era who's a glutton? And in fact, in two episodes, he is called Little Piggy. So he seemed perfect in every way.
I'm a little piggy, here's my snack. Oink, 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 oink.
That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. It's not easy for anybody to make poetry into a full-time job, but even for a poet, Mary Jo Bang, who did not start writing until she was in her 30s, has an unusually long and eclectic resume. 4 degrees, dozens of odd jobs that include welfare caseworker, physician's assistant, table busser, and department store model. But during the last couple of decades, Mary Jo Bang has become known as a poet's poet, winning all kinds of awards and fellowships. Her books regularly make those year-end best-of lists. She's even translated Dante's Inferno. Her latest book of poetry is called The Last 2 Seconds, and she's here. Mary Jo Bang, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
You didn't start publishing poetry until the late 1980s when you were in your, I guess you'd passed 40. What took you so long?
What took me so long? Having to make a living, having to be a mother. I did some political activism. After I finished my master's, I went to Philadelphia and worked with a group of Quakers called the Philadelphia Life Center, doing community organizing and nonviolent teaching. So
you really are like somebody from a different century.
I am, and I'm almost from a different century.
Yeah. This new book is called The Last 2 Seconds. What is the significance of that? What does that mean?
Well, I think that it talks to two things. It talks to the fact that time goes very quickly and that in an eye blink, we've gone from 1900 to the 21st century. And
let alone from 40 to 60.
Exactly. And then there's this sense of menace today. This could be the last 2 seconds. We walk around with that anxiety. So I'm trying to, like all good poetry, layer meaning, and it begins with that title. So it's about the past and it's about the future.
Time, freezing time, capturing moments is a recurrent idea and theme in this book. Where do you think that comes from in you?
Well, I think that all poets have preoccupations and obsessions, and then even without their trying, those preoccupations get played out in the poems. So I didn't begin with that idea that every poem's going to talk about time. But when I collected the poems that I had written over a period of time and I printed them out and I looked at them, I was shocked to find out that indeed that was a major preoccupation with these poems.
Do you think it's being in your 60s? Because I know as I age, I have a greater consciousness of the seconds and minutes remaining.
I think absolutely it is. I think that also once you get into your 60s, you know that you have X amount of time and X, we can't solve for X, but it's X now opposed to X plus X plus X.
Or nth.
Yes.
Do you think poets, as you do in your poetry, have some kind of responsibility to refer to and use current events in their work?
No, not at all. I don't legislate what anybody should write. And because these ultimately are word games that we play with ourselves, by ourselves, no, people should play whatever game they want. It's like a giant crossword puzzle.
It's really interesting to me that you refer to poetry as a word game and a crossword puzzle, which is so totally unpretentious. It's just a word game I'm doing here. It's not some grand award-winning artistic achievement.
Yeah. I very much feel that way,
yeah.
And I'm very suspicious of people who want to make it more than that.
Well, speaking of reading poetry, will you read us a poem?
I'd be happy to.
And what I would love to hear you read is Let's Say Yes, 6, There She Was.
There she was. The house stood. The cars were standing. She was walking over to the dog, which had to be remembered. Shake hands, she said. He straightened, bent, straightened. His manner was irreproachable, that being with a tail. It was extraordinary, life was. Furs being petted, people standing upright, panic, fear, tight skirts, ankles, thought. The creature standing, her giving little pats. She was enjoying standing there. She had forgotten this feeling. Ordinary things, curtains, biscuits, bones, a creature raising one foreleg, the movies. She stood looking as if she would solidify, Darwin draped in black, remembering the flora or fauna. Of course, she would really only be remembering a garden, trees, wallpaper, a sea lion barking, a doctor of misery on the verge of difficulty, a boy gone, death, death without life, terror, fear, disaster, punishment, profound darkness, evening. She walked to the window, sky, clouds coming into the room. How odd, she thought, to be.
That was Mary Jo Bang reading Let's Say Yes, 6. There she was, from her new collection, The Last 2 Seconds. In your footnotes, you talk about where the language for that poem comes from, which I needed to read to, because I'm not smart enough to have recognized it otherwise. Explain.
Well, that is an erasure of the last 50 pages of Virginia Woolf's novel, Mrs. Dalloway. And what I did was to select different words and create sentences out of those words, going forward, never back, and write a poem that was inimitably mine, but limiting myself to only those words that I found during my reading forward in those pages.
It, which sounds like an exercise that you, Professor Bang, would assign students. Was that what it was, assigning yourself a kind of poetry exercise?
Yes, it was.
The end of that poem you read mentions a boy gone, and you mentioned that you lost a son, which your last book of poetry, Elegy, deals with mourning his death. He died as an adult. Did writing Elegy change the way you feel or think about him and his death?
No, but it changed the way I think about writing, and that is that I wrote those not as poems to be shared, but once they were shared, people responded to them, and it made me see that it was possible to be less veiled in my poetry than perhaps I had been before then. It's up to the poet to find a way to communicate, to share on the page, to share something about the human experience.
So, translating Dante's Inferno a few years ago, first, along the way, when did you learn Italian well enough to do that?
I don't know Italian.
Oh.
I used existing translations, and there are over 200 translations into English.
Well, so I could do that.
You could indeed.
So I'm interested in the process of how you did that. So you take these, whatever you consider the best English translations, and then begin with those?
I started with one. And it was Charles Singleton's 1972. I would read the canto, and then I would read perhaps 5 other translations. I could see what was going on. I could see the liberties that each of these 5 translators had taken. So that gave me permission to come up with my own way of saying it, but it established the borders. Okay, you can't go outside of these borders, or if you go outside, you have to have a reason.
And there are references in it to people like John Wayne Gacy and Stephen Colbert and Cartman from South Park. What was your intention? And you obviously knew that this is going to freak out certain traditionalists when you did this.
I did know that. That's never stopped me before, and I don't think it should stop anyone, those kinds of anxieties about breaking with tradition. Dante wrote the Divine Comedy in the vernacular. And we even
which is a big deal that he didn't write it in Latin.
Exactly. He wanted everyone to be able to read it who could read. And he said it had to be in the language with which we talk to our family, our friends, our lovers. So I wanted to do the equivalent. I thought if I'm going to put it in the language of today, maybe I should also bring hell forward into today. So who would we see in hell now, for instance? Hitler should definitely, I believe, be in hell, in Dante's hell.
And were the contemporary pop cultural figures you use, or Hitler being in hell, the equivalents in Dante were whom?
Anytime there was a character where for hundreds of years commentators could not find a historical figure.
Clever.
Yes. I would then feel that I could have permission. So with Eric Cartman, for instance, that person is in the circle of gluttony. So Dante asks the character, what's your name? And he gives a nickname that in Italian means piggy or hog. I thought, now who's the iconic figure of our era who's a glutton? Eric Cartman came to mind. And in fact, in 2 episodes, he is called Little Piggy. Once by an optometrist And another time he's made to sing a song, "I'm a little piggy, oink, oink, oink." So he seemed perfect in every way.
"I'm a little piggy, here's my snack. Oink, 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 oink."
So you teach and have taught for years at Washington University in St. Louis. Do the youth require or respond to a translation of Inferno with Cartman references and Colbert references?
They seem to. I talk to a lot of young people, and they tell me things like, "I always wanted to read this, but I tried several times and couldn't." And that's indeed exactly the person for whom I wrote this, because I was one of those people too.
Your own poetry, speaking of accessibility, is difficult often. It seems like you're doing a different thing when you write your own poetry than you did with the Dante translation.
This idea about difficulty is a really complicated
one.
Yes,
it is. But key to making people ever want to read poetry.
That's right. I think there are, I'll say two things. One is that I'm trying not to be reductive about complicated problems. I think the other thing I'll say is that many people go to poetry not for just the content, but to see how language can be arranged on the page in order to play a word game where how do you make something mean but also use expressive sound, also use layering of meaning so that something might mean two things at once. But it takes a reader who wants to unpack that meaning. And sometimes it's the failure of schools not to teach that kind of reading because it's a fun way to read. And that's why poetry is fun for those who know how to read it.
Well, for somebody who puts so much doom and menace and dread in her poems, you certainly don't convey that in real life. And for that, I am grateful. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Mary Jo Bang's latest book of poetry, The Last 2 Seconds, is out right now. Here at Studio 360, we love all kinds of music. We've featured superstar choral composers like Eric Whitaker. And big deal indie rockers like St. Vincent.
Oh, what an ordinary day.
But I have never had the chance to do both at once. Until I heard a new record by a group called the Silver Lake Chorus.
The Silver Lake Chorus is a group of about 20 people, part chorus, part indie band. I'm Mikey Wells, and I'm the music director.
The Chorus is based in Los Angeles, named after one of the LA hipster neighborhoods. The idea was to perform covers of familiar indie rock songs. Then their friend, a songwriter and producer named Ben Lee, had an idea. Why not get indie rockers to write original new songs for the Chorus and put out a record?
The current album is a combination of songs by really great, cool indie artists, songs that they gave us exclusively for the album that we arranged for Chorus.
And they got some pretty impressive names. The Flaming Lips, Ben Gibbard, and Justin Vernon all wrote songs for them. But it's the last track on the album that really caught my attention.
I'm Amy Mann.
I'm Paul Bryan.
Amy Mann and her producer-collaborator Paul Bryan sent the Silver Lake Chorus a song they wrote called Easy to Die. It's inspired by a friend of Amy's who overdosed. I was intrigued by this improbable notion, a choral work about a drug overdose. So I asked Amy, Paul, and Mikey to listen to the song with me and walk me through how they created it.
I was thinking of that sort of descending chord progression and God Bless the Child. Just sounds so beautiful right off the bat, like that piano sound.
It's so easy to die, an unsteady hand and such a
my good friend Nick had this janky piano in his studio that he wasn't actually sure the last time it had been tuned. And we loved the sort of ragtag sound of it.
I mean, it already sounds like two ghosts singing from beyond the grave.
Reap while the other saps dig. That makes me laugh.
Yeah.
It's Colin.
The other saps dig. It's got that atmosphere of like, I'm taking the easy way out. You know, I'm not doing the work like these people.
We had no prompt from her. We had no insight into her songwriting process. Really, all the information you need is right in front of you. It's in the song, it's in the lyrics, it's in the melody. And I think we found it to be a really cool challenge to sort of be given the raw materials and say, go. What are you going to do? We tracked the whole chorus singing the whole melody in its harmony. We tracked individual people doing it. We tracked all boys. We tracked all girls. And what we ended up doing was starting with two voices, then adding two more for the second verse, and then two more for the first chorus, and so on and so on. It's no trick to go boom. A fatal faux pas,
and presto voila, it's 180. That's my favorite one. That's presto voila, it's 180 proof. Here's mud in your eye.
And it's all those, like, alcoholic, drug addict, you know, what should be a good time, jocular statement. But also literally, here's mud in your eye. And then I picture, like, you know, throwing dirt on the coffin.
This little round where they're singing back and forth with each other.
It's really gorgeous.
It's beautiful. That's a new addition that I just love.
You know, the drug addict doesn't bear any of the worry about what happens to him. Everybody around the drug addict bears the worry. And the drug addict, it is like, it is, here's mud in your eye. It's all, you know, it's all good times until it's over.
The Silver Lake Chorus's debut album is just out, and you can hear some tracks at studio360.org. To close the show, this week, we lost E.L. Doctorow, the great American author of historical fiction, of Ragtime and Loon Lake and Billy Bathgate and more. He was 84. When Doctorow came on the show in 2005, I was especially excited because I was then in the middle of writing my own first historical novel. He had just published his 10th. And he told me that he was starting to see his novels as kind of one giant novel.
It just seemed that I had, I don't know, a repertory company. And some of the people were going on news and standing in the wings, so I just pulled them on stage. But someone pointed out to me that all these books could be put together in some fashion to suggest a kind of saga. And there you have 150 years of what this country is gone through, but this was nothing I planned.
And I know what you call a trilogy and a tetralogy, but when you get up to 8 or 9 books, I don't know what it's called.
Well, it's called Being Very Lucky.
Ed Doctorow was lucky, and we were lucky to have him. That's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Molinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Becca Forsman,
Kushelle Stocks,
Dasha Lisitsina,
Jack DiSidoro.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the novel that brought white America face to face with racism.
Richard Wright was saying, let's stop asking for permission. Let's stop selling ourselves. Let's stop apologizing. If you're angry and you know it, clap your hands. You know?
I'm Kurt Anderson, Richard Wright's native son. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.